Hey y'all, just a little warning before you head on into the show. We recorded this before Johnny broke the news that Jericho Sims will be out for the rest of the year. So go into it with that understanding. Enjoy. Hey y'all, it's Timber Football for the next hour. I'm your host, Will Bazer, and I'm joined alongside by Johnny Brashear and Timothy Preston. You guys listen to the Horns Cast.
17 minutes. Sorry.
You guys are listening to the Horns Cast. That's the Horns Cast channel on any podcasting platform out there. Today we're going to be talking about Texas basketball. Surprise, surprise. It's there. It's still basketball season. Talk about that game against Texas Tech and how you lose a 15-point lead. Talk about Baylor and Fran Fraschilla's comments on Texas. And then get into the question, is there still a path to the tournament for Texas, especially with two games that they should win in Iowa State and TCU? And then today's Pretend You're Getting the Know-Us question is, what's the worst movie you've seen from start to finish? Y'all, let's get into... Really, I want to get into Fran Fraschilla's comments to start off here. Okay. Because, again, another basketball announcer has something to say about Shaka Smart in some way that they're trying to, you know, pull for Shaka Smart. And I understand that Shaka Smart's a really likable guy, but this just seems to happen. Like, it happened when Charlie Strong was the head coach at Texas, and it happened in the waning days of Rick Barnes and Mack Brown, where Fran Fraschilla kind of gave Texas fans a warning, saying, be careful what you wish for. In a quote, I'd be shocked if they get a guy like Chris Beard to leave Texas Tech. He's, Shaka Smart, has got a young team. He's had some injuries. You got to tell me who you'd hire before you make a coaching change, especially if you're going to pay the man $1 million. So he's saying that...
$10 million, sorry.
That he doesn't think that Texas is going to get a guy who will bring them more success. And then he goes on to say, Texas has been in the past about excellence. And let's be honest, most of their major sports are not very good right now. 7-5 in football doesn't cut it. Women's basketball is okay. Baseball is horrible. That's not Texas athletics. I mean, there's a lot of things you can take into this, like, you know, Texas football has had a 10-win season and a Sugar Bowl in the past 2 years. Baseball went to Omaha. Women's basketball, it, you know, seems to be having a down year rather than a down period. And also the first two parts of this quote don't really match well together. What are your thoughts on this, Tim?
My thoughts are, you know, they're unchanged from last time that we talked. You know, I think that Fraschilla is kind of a tool and have for a long time. He sent his kid to Oklahoma, for God's sakes. This is not going to be a particularly popular comment right now. Look, he's not wrong, you know, and I... Was getting rid of Charlie Strong the right choice? Absolutely. You see what he's done at USF, and like, yeah, like no question. Like,
they
obviously
won a title since then, right? Like national title at USF. Was it? Is that not correct?
wrong school.
Oh,
UCF.
Oh,
was that the joke, Johnny? Was that just explain the joke?
I don't know. Let's keep rolling.
You know, so I'm not sure. Look, there's competing pieces for me with this. I mean, on the one hand, it's very on brand for any fan base, particularly the Texas fan base, to be like, we know more than the professional prognosticators, so go fuck yourselves. On the other hand,
it's a regular comment in the reviews of this podcast, by the way.
right. We're rocking like 0.8% on iTunes. It's unfortunate, but
we are almost to a full star.
but in more than just a theoretical sense, he's accurate. If you're looking for examples of coaches that turn it on after, you know, probably too long of a time period, they're out there. I hate to bring myself into this too much, but look, I've experienced something not dissimilar from what Shaka is, probably at a much worse level. So there is a part of me as a coach and as someone
probably who... it's kind of similar level, but you know, maybe a little bit lower of a level.
Well, look, we went 0-14 4 years ago. So I don't mean like the level as far of play. I mean like the level of like how bad we were. Like Shock has been bad. He has not been 0-14 in year 8, right? So that I was 0-14 in year 8.
I'd like but, it noted. I signed the petition for you to be fired.
Thank you. Believe it or not, anyways, it's fine. So I don't know. I hate to be too reactionary to any of this stuff. I also hate to be too thoughtful to any coach. What Fran is saying, and I think that disagree with him or agree with him, you have to at least understand where he's coming from. The chances that Shaka can't coach, period, are extremely small. So if Shaka can coach, the question simply becomes, is he not good enough, or is there something inherent about the job at Texas that's going to keep him from, or keep anyone from being successful right away? Now, it's hard to say yes to that, given what we know about Rick and his time here, but look, the three in-state teams during Rick's first season at Texas, as far as their Big 12 records, they won 10 games. Tech, Baylor, and A&M, Rick's first season, they won 10 games total in the Big 12. Rick's second year, those same three Big 12 Texas teams, I think, won either 11 or 12 games. The following year, they won 17. So even as they were progressing, they were still, and that was, I think, even the 17 year, I think 10 of those wins were Texas Tech when they had, you know, when Bob Knight was around, they had Andre Emmett and they had some of those guys. Now, so people who talk about Rick did this, Rick did that, they're right. I mean, certainly he did. But you know who got good on Rick Barnes's tenure on his watch? Baylor and Tech. And now TCU to a certain extent. I don't tell people who are calling for Shaka's job wrong, but I do want to caution people that Fran's been around the game for a long time. He's seen a lot of coaches. Like, he's privy to practices that we don't get a chance to be there. He sees them in the film room. You know, he understands. Like I mean, shit, how many games has Fran called for Texas? Like, 7 or 8 this year? It's been a lot. Like, maybe as many as Lance and Lowell.
Yeah, it's the cocaine chinchilla, yes.
Right. So, I mean, on the one hand, I think that, like I said, Fran is a bit of a tool. On the other hand, he's seen the program a lot. He's had a chance to be in practices. He knows how to scout players. There's a reason that ESPN has him on their NBA draft stuff. Like, I don't know. So, why did he say what he did? Do I agree with him? I don't know. But do I understand, like, how to look at Shaka and say, like, yeah, he's right. Okay, so who do we get next? Right? Who do we get next? What is it? And is sort of like the anybody but Shaka, is that truly the right play right now? Whoever we get, absolutely anybody. Just fire Shaka and we'll pick up the pieces later. It can't be worse than this. Is that true? Is it wrong? Will it be right in hindsight? I mean, maybe, probably. But I don't know. It's more nuanced than just like, fuck that guy. I'm through with him. Whatever.
Counterpoint, fuck that guy.
Are you through with him?
Yeah, no. I was through with Fran. I was through with Fran. That's who I was saying. I was saying fuck Fran.
That's fine.
So
that doesn't hurt my feelings one bit.
Setting aside that Fran has turned into a bit of a, I don't know, a somewhat subdued Dick Vitale, where he seems to be going a bit more in hyperbole than he used to. Setting that aside, I do think it's pretty funny how angry he made Kevin Dunn about the whole baseball is horrible thing. you might as well have told him that the real world was bullshit. It was quite a shot across the bow of Kevin Dunn. There's a bunch we could sort of deconstruct from that, but I think one of the things I'm going to take issue with is the fact that this idea of, okay, tell me who you're going to get first before you fire Shaka. Like, the two, maybe earlier, maybe a year or two ago, that is the very valid question. Like, you need to have somebody lined up if you're going to pay that kind of money to get rid of a guy. Like, I get that. But we are in year 5. And At this point, if you do not think Shaka is the answer, then you don't think he's the answer. And as more to the point, if CDC doesn't think he's the answer, then he's not the answer. And you need to get rid of him in some form or fashion, right? Whether it's finding him another landing spot, whether it's firing him and paying out the full remaining salary, whatever, right? Like there's areas there. But if you have made the decision that Shaka is not the guy, then that's the decision, and who you're going to get to replace him is the next decision. It is not part of the initial decision. Like, I hesitate a little bit on this in that, it is year five. Shaka is not produced to this point reliably, and I understand that there's a downside to letting him go because you could get someone worse. You absolutely could. Like, Shaka has underperformed, but he has not been woefully inadequate. And the question is, do you think he can go find someone who will improve upon the last few years? And it's a bit ironic that one of the coaches I've been sort of side-eyeing the entire time took 6 years to make his first NCAA tournament. But there are guys out there who can take this and run with it and theoretically do better than him. It's always a gamble, no matter who you get. But I don't agree that you have to tie the decision of who can you get to whether or not you get rid of the guy. Like, at the end of the day, if you do not think the person who is in charge of the team, in charge of the program, is capable of leading it where you want it to be, then the next decision is its own decision independent of that, because you've already made a value judgment on the current status. So we can quibble with who would be, you know, who would be an improvement or not or whatever. But if you're going to sit there and say, this guy's not the answer, then you need to figure out a way to move past him.
And on that point, it sort of falls into the sunk cost fallacy, which is costs that have already been incurred cannot be recovered. So worrying about those costs in the future is not going to help with future decisions. So the fact that he's saying, especially if you're going to pay this man $10 million, well, they're going to pay him whether or not he's at Texas, right? It's a sunk cost at this point. Take that $10 million and push it to the side at this point, because it's happening whether or not Shaka Smart is here. Look forward and see potential or future costs and future benefits. That's the idea here. So if you can go out, forget about the $10 million that they're paying him and go out and think about if those potential benefits outweigh those costs, then this is worth it. It's worth it.
And I think it's fair to, I mean, we have to acknowledge the reality that you know, CDC has to find somebody to pay that money, right? Like, somebody's got to foot that bill. At the end of the day, it's a matter of finding boosters or whoever who are motivated enough to pay that, so that the next step becomes available. Because if he can't find that, well, guess what? Another year of Shaka is coming up. Because, like you said, it is a sunk cost, and there is something to paying that over the course of 3 or 4 years, as opposed to paying it in one. Because at the end of the day, this is a business, and CDC's got to operate like a business. If he can't get somebody to fund that, and he can't find it elsewhere, then that choice has been made in that direction as well. So I'm not disagreeing with your point. It's just we have to acknowledge the reality that somebody has to foot that bill. And if even with Texas sort of muddling along in this, you know, second straight NIT sort of world, there's still actual dollars that need to be paid out before any sort of move can be made.
There are, and I think there's another part to it too, where I guess in some ways I think Fran is maybe most right with his statement of like, okay, who do you get? Who do you get? And like, this is where CDC needs to make his money, because, all right, so Will, if you're going to bring in that paradigm into what we're talking about here, and I think it's a totally valid one, the question is going to be, this is not a normal time for Texas. There's one more year in the Irwin Center, and then they open up the Moody Center. And so much has been made, and so many things have been talking about, like, okay, well, when we open that in 2021, how much hype, how much hysteria, how much positive feelings about the program is going to be there? Well, let's say we just, if the people are like, look, we just, no matter what, we have to get rid of Shaka. If that ends up happening, at least one of the somewhat plausible scenarios is a decent amount of the players leave. You know, at that point, if Shaka's gone, does Jericho leave? Does Matt leave, or Courtney, or Jace? I mean, or Andrew, or like whoever, like how many of those guys take off? And if they do take off and we're left with this hodgepodge of grad transfers or JUCO transfers or like reaches from high school seniors. And I don't want to be like a chicken little, like, well, if you fire Shaka, you know, think of all the terrible things that could happen. That's like, you know, anytime there's a switch, like there's probably going to be some pretty significant, or at least some turnover, or at the, you know, or there's going to be a year of kind of getting to know you stuff with that. But if we go into year one at the Moody Center and there's a new coach, and that new coach is coming off of something, oh, let's just say like Shaka's first true year here where he was 11-22 or whatever it was, what does that mean for us? What does that mean moving forward? Was it truly worth it? Who did we hire? So Will's right. Like, okay, so you're paying that $10 million and that money is just gone regardless. But then so what? I mean, are we going to hire a $2 million coach a year? Is that guy out there? Do we care about him? I mean, how? It's just, man, because this year of all is so weird, because if you start looking at some of the coaches that are maybe hot names right now, like the Penn State coach or something like that, like his first 7 years were way worse than Shaka's first five have been here. So do we entrust the program to a guy like him? Do we, you know, do we think that, or whatever, right? It's just, I don't mean to like to allow that the analysis to paralyze us, but I do want to, you have to at least pay homage to the idea that there's, this year seems like there's almost no real true, okay, this guy's going to get it done. Or if there is a guy like that, I think it's just as possible that he doesn't come to Texas as if, like, oh, yeah, well, if we just throw whatever money at him, it's going to happen. Because clearly this is not a throw whatever money at people kind of program at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, I'm probably going to agree to disagree on that point with you. I mean, I get conceptually where you're going with it, right? Like, it makes sense.
Right.
I think given that Texas is, I think we would both consider it a top 20 spot for coaches, there are enough solid to above average coaching options out there that Texas can figure something out. If CDC does this properly, right? Like, that's the big if, because we haven't seen him really do this with a quote-unquote big hire yet. Like, he hasn't had to do football. He hasn't had to do basketball. Like, he hasn't had, didn't have to do baseball, right? Like, that was Perrin who brought in Pierce, right? I'm pretty sure. So
I believe so.
Yeah, so... And to be honest, it is fair to note that CDC's basketball hires at his previous stops have been pretty underwhelming. Jamie Dixon is the notable exception, and he basically fell into the lap because he was an alum who Pitt got tired of. Like, so,
and who knows how long he'll be there.
Yeah, well, he's not in any hot water if what I understand from the TCU people is fine. So, because they're happy to just think about being the NCAA tournament based on their history. So, yeah, you know, unless he leaves of his own volition. Anyway, point being, it is fair to want Shaka gone. It is fair to understand the financial costs and the opportunity costs that are involved. It is also fair to note that, as Tim points out, whoever comes after him could be considerably worse. That's also entirely possible.
But no, could be better.
Could be better, but
could
also
be better.
Right.
Yeah, but no, so what I meant to say was he could be better, but have such a shitty first year that like all of this hype that's gone into the Moody Center
Right.
And like, okay, we're building towards this, we're building towards this. Like, even a great coach might really struggle that first year when Shaka's gone if the players like Shaka as much as we think they do and decide to take off. Like, I don't think that Coleman and Sims would take off, but if they do, like, all of a sudden you're looking at a roster that might really, really, really struggle, even with a very good coach.
Yeah, and you can't assume anyone will stay just because anytime a coaching staff is turned over, there's going to be player turnover. That's just that's a fact of things. Like, there may be somewhat less turnover for Texas, if only because a number of the guys are sort of at that position in their eligibility where, I mean, you know, maybe Coleman could grad transfer or something. I don't know if that's an option, but like, most there's a significant chunk of these guys who might stick around because it's their best move. So
yeah, no differently than Lammer and Felix and Howland and whoever else when Shaka was here.
I think if we're looking for sort of an analog here, Buzz Williams, he's not doing great at A&M right now. He's having a bad first year, but he's doing a massive turnover, and it seems like the A&M people understand that, are willing to roll with it, especially if he can show progress in year two. So I'm less concerned about that bad first year here, especially given that they'll have a new arena. And I mean, the first 2 years at the Irwin Center, they packed the thing out, whether the games were good or not, because it was new. So I'm less concerned about sort of that forward momentum, I guess is what I'm saying.
Okay. And on top of that, one thing that you're looking for in a hire is margin, you know, at least understanding where things are going, the progress, or at least understanding why things are going bad, and that there is going to be change, that there is something that can happen along the way that is in the coach's control.
Yeah, and that's fair.
The past two games, kind of reminiscent of what has been going on in Shaka Smart's entire tenure. It has been very difficult to watch. We'll talk about it in a second, because again, it's just two games that are very reminiscent of why Longhorn fans are upset and kind of done with Shaka Smart. Okay, you have an amazing point. No need to call me butthole over Skype. You want to go? Go. Come on. Do it. Oh, you did not have an amazing point? Okay, whatever. Just call me a butthole. Nobody knows. This is terrible for podcasting. But you just ruined a great transition, Johnny.
It was quite good.
I hope you're happy with that.
You're my favorite butthole of this group. How's that?
Wow. Tim, you hear that? You upset?
No, he's like old faithful.
There's a new favorite butthole
there
in town.
He's old faithful. I can always go back to that. You're the new hotness. That's.
I do think you have a dynamite butthole, John.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate that.
He did say Johnny, just for the record.
I said Johnny.
Oh, damn it.
All right.
You know, you're right, Will. And I think, okay.
No, all go, right, go, fine. Go. No. This is wonderful podcasting material. Go ahead, Tim.
I have no idea what I was going to say. Truly not.
Okay, great.
Start talking.
So that brings me
to my next point.
Before we get into the Texas Tech and Baylor, I do want to talk about two injuries that were pretty important for those two games, which are Kai Jones and Jace's injuries. How big were they in Texas Tech and the Baylor games? Would those two games' outcomes have changed, which would probably have changed basically this entire conversation we had in the first half of this episode? Would that have changed? Would these games have changed with Jace and Kai in it?
I feel like it might have changed the Tech game in that it was a close game. I really liked a lot of what Jace was doing defensively in Tech. He was active. He was helping a lot, which was sort of an interesting twist. You know, you saw him play a lot of help defense from the weak side, which was interesting. He's also become one of the better post-entry passers on the team, which is nice. So, you know, in a Tech game where the game was sort of won and lost on the margins, he was providing some of those marginal values up until the point in time when he got hurt. Kai, I'm not so sure if he would have, you know, been integral to the sort of the final margin against Tech. Maybe, because he seemed like he was really interested in rebounding. I mean, and he's always an energy guy, right? So he could have been. I'm very concerned moving forward with the two of them because, I'm not so much concerned with Kai because his is sort of high ankle sprain and that goes how it goes, right? Some guys heal from that more quickly than others. Jace, I'm not very optimistic on seeing anytime soon, which sucks because not only is he the sort of primary perimeter threat on this team, he has been a more active defender than any time in the past couple of years. Like he's stepped that part of his game up, which is nice. And he's been sort of a willing rebounder at times at least on the defensive end. It hurts a team that is this based on the 3-point shot, having the guy who can get the shot up the quickest, being out for the foreseeable future is a problem. It's rough. It's not like, it's not on the level of losing Andrew Jones to leukemia kind of rough, but it's still, it hurts their ceiling. It hurts their future. And I would say that losing the two of them combined probably changed that tech loss or potential tech win into a loss.
Yeah. And I guess I'd actually, you know, I don't want to totally switch around what Johnny just said. I would probably go the opposite way, though. I actually think that Texas really could use Kai at the end of the Tech game.
You son of a bitch.
It's true. Just because Jericho was so much of a non-factor against Tech that,
yeah, that's true.
You know, maybe Kai could have, you know, been an impact player towards the end.
He also and then got really Jericho in foul trouble real early.
Yeah, and then against Baylor, like if I had to choose, like if I could like pinpoint one thing that I was very frustrated about is that we passed up open shots to pass to people who were more guarded than the guys who pass up open shots. So like,
many times.
So like if I could have chosen one guy, like, oh, this guy needs to be on the floor so he can shoot those open shots, I guess it would have been Jace. So to not have him and like have someone that would step into those shots confidently like a number of times. Both Courtney and I guess a little bit Kamaka and for sure Donovan Williams, they had open looks and just didn't take them. So if those looks would have happened to go to Jace, that probably would have been a more positive impact than what we got. But I mean, Johnny's right. Like I don't know if I would say they change the games completely, but you know, when you're talking about a 5-point loss or a 7-point loss, like that's, in the grand scheme of things, like there's pretty easy ways that a guy like Jace or a guy like Kai can, you know, can make up for those kind of point totals. So regardless, neither of them are huge impact players, but at their best, they certainly could have made a difference here or there at the very least.
I think it's fair to say, sorry, Will, I'm going to cut you off.
Yet do again. It.
Again. Okay. All right.
No, I'm happy about it. Good. Yeah,
I appreciate your flexibility here, both physically and emotional. I feel like with
I got so
busy making jokes at Will's expense, I lost my point. Anyway, so I feel like if Jace is in that Tech game, he's just, he was so active defensively, and they had enough chances, right? Like that game was severely winnable, and it's that maybe the most frustrating part about it that I really would have liked to have him around. Also, like you were talking about in the Baylor game, I mean, Jace has gone off against them at least a couple of times, if not three or four, and so yeah,
never at home, to be frank, never at home.
That's fair,
but
God damn it! All right, yeah, never mind. I rescind my point. I have never seen, well, maybe not never. I shouldn't use that sort of hyperbole, but I have rarely seen a team so willing to pass the defense back into position as Texas was against Baylor. They had, I have two main gripes about the offense against Baylor. One is that the guards seem terrified of making layups. Like they would beat their guy in pick and roll, go into the paint and then stop and look around for somebody or something. Like I don't really know what they were trying to do there. It's like they saw a green jersey and went, nope, okay, closed. The other is that we had a number of situations where there, whether it was through a kick out or an offensive rebound, which holy shit, we got offensive rebounds. They had wide open threes that they would pass around the rim. Cause it's like Hepa would get it and pass it to, you know, Donovan, who would get it and pass it to Courtney, who would pass it to Matt, who then reset the offense, but it didn't matter because the defense who was over on the, like on the other side of the court was out of position, but they're back on the other side of the court. So now they're back in position. It's like, hey, we just passed you back into the spot you needed to be. And I'm not even going to get into Andrew Jones at this point, but they, it was just take a, like, I get people are frustrated by the amount of threes they take, but take the fucking open threes already.
Yeah.
Like they're there. It's not even contested. It's, Hepa is wide open or Ramey is wide open. And they just, they were like, oh, passed around the rim. That's what somebody told me to do. And it's just, oh my God, I just.
If the number four defense in the country gives you an open shot, you take it. Yep. Yeah. Yep. That's what you do.
Yep. And they had a make or miss. You take that shot and they just repeatedly did not do it. And it drove me insane.
Well, on the Texas Tech game, going back to that, how do you lose a 15-point lead when you hold a team to 19 points in the first half? I mean, the defense was off the wall, but the second half, it just fell apart, and especially around the 15-minute mark where Texas Tech went on a 9-0 run to tie the game up and really take it over. It's almost like in the first half when they have 15 points, they're going to lose it. They're going to lose. It's Georgetown all over again, right? You just knew it. But, geez, I mean, is there a more Shaka Smart defining game? Like, this defines Shaka Smart's tenure, this type of game.
Yeah, it does. So does the 2018 Duke game. So does the tournament game against Nevada. So does the, you know, I mean, like, you name the game that we've been up big.
The
and
Baylor
then
game?
Lose.
Oh
yeah, sure. Right, and I think that without putting too much stress or too much emphasis on just a couple of guys, obviously I'm a huge proponent for Matt Coleman. All three of us have had our moments where we've been very big proponents for Courtney Ramey, but when those guys both have a 5 or 6 minute stretch against a team like Tech or a team like Baylor or a team like, you know, whatever team it might be that we play well for a while and then give it up, Kansas, whatever. If Matt's going to have 2 turnovers in 4 possessions and Courtney's going to have 2 turnovers in 3 possessions, like, good teams are going to take advantage of that, particularly when they're live ball turnovers. And we haven't been able to avoid those enough times in clutch moments or when, you know, things get really heated and contested in some of those games. Like, I don't want to say we've been at our worst, but we certainly have not been at our best. And so how do we lose a team that, you know, when we're up by 15? Well, look, they convert better than us. They find ways to shut down some of our go-to offensive players. And in some of those clutch moments where we need for our ball handlers to make great decisions or get us into the action that we need, Courtney Ramey is throwing it to a guy that's sitting in the stands. Like, you know, I mean, I don't even know how many times Courtney has thrown the ball.
And then he blames it on somebody.
He jerks his head and looks down and claps his hands together with a grimace on his face. Like, what the fuck, dude? Every single game? And you're still upset with someone else? Come on.
I don't even know if he's blaming someone else. I mean, sometimes he's blaming someone else, right? But sometimes he's just disgusted with himself, but he still takes himself out of a play, right? Like, he gets – there was one of those turnovers where – or it was like a missed layup or something where he got some contact and he just like he looked at the bench like he was disgusted, and meanwhile the ball is 10 feet ahead of him going the other way, and I'm just like, God damn it, man. I understand being disappointed. I mean, there are significant portions of my life that are disappointments, but I don't
do
like,
you yeah. Do you understand being disappointed, Johnny?
I do.
Do you?
I do. Have you seen my penis? It's very mediocre.
So smooth.
Yes. It's just like I'm just move on, man. Just move on. You know, grouse about it during the under 16 timeout or whatever. Like, if it, maybe we could make a Ramey box. Like, he just goes into a, like a sort of a makeshift closet behind Andrea Hootie in every TV timeout where he just sits there and cusses and screams and whatever. And he comes out and he's like, I'm ready to go for the next 4 minutes. There we go.
It's
like
filled with marshmallows and things he can punch and run into.
Yeah, it's like, it's just a big, there's a giant Nerf gun and there's a target. Yeah, just something. Like, he just, like, you got, like, there's playing with an edge and then there's just letting the emotions get the better of yourself. And I feel he is too far on the other side of that.
So you're saying that it was Courtney Ramey's fault?
If there's two guys for whom this season can most be attributed to, one I think is Shaka Smart, or Bear. I mean, Shaka slash Neil. But if you're looking for a player to say, okay, well, why have we not been better? I guess he's my main culprit on the floor. You guys can't disagree. You don't disagree with that, do you?
In the last three games, Courtney Ramey's offensive rating, and mind you, 100 is average. Against Kansas, it was 46. Against Texas Tech, it was 68. And against Baylor, it was 54. He's not been good. He's just not been good. Like, and it is interesting if you go back and look through this season, most of the games where his offensive rating is over 100, wins. Most of them are under 100, losses. Like, he has been... I feel like he is maybe, Will Baker's pretty high on this list. He might be the most disappointing player this year, if only because I expected him to take a leap that he clearly has not. And it's not that he hasn't stayed still. It's that he seems significantly worse or significantly more unreliable this year. And I'm honestly surprised by it because he has a lot of talent and when he's on, and like it just seems like he's not. I don't know. He's just not putting it together like I thought he would.
Sophomore slump.
Well, I thought he was going to be a more consistent Roach.
Yeah,
and he's probably been less consistent, or maybe even like just simply worse.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know. Like, we needed him to be high quality, or at least like high-ish quality Roach, and it hasn't been even close to that. So
Well, the thing about Texas though is it's still not all lost. I don't think there's still a path to the tournament, right? Or do y'all think that is just gone at this point?
There is a hairline path that has basically no room for error.
Yeah.
Like, aside from, like, win the Big 12 tournament, of course, but that would be tough because at this point we're probably looking at the 7 seed, which means beating Kansas in Kansas City and then beating likely either Tech or West Virginia before beating either Baylor or Tech. Like, I don't think winning the conference tournament is a very doable option at this point. So I mean, yeah, for sure there's a way to do it, and I mean, crazier things have happened, but it's hairline at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is I don't disagree with anything Tim said, for the record. So when I come up with these alternate paths, understand that I agree with Tim that they are marginal at best. And honestly, just not great. Any chance Texas had of going 10-8 in conference probably went out the window when they lost to Tech. That is the game that they should have flipped if they were going to try and mount a winning record in the Big 12 conference. There's a good chance that 9-9 or even potentially 8-10, depending on where they, you know, which games they win, gets them into the 5 spot in the tournament. Like, the top 4 are going to be, in some order, Baylor, Kansas, Texas Tech, and West Virginia. Like, that's fairly set. I might have thought Tech was, you know, Potentially a 5 seed in Big 12 tournament if they had lost to Texas, but that clearly did not happen. So at this point, you're looking at Texas is 4-7. There's no way they're winning 6 in their next 7, right? Like that's to get to 10-8. That's just not happening. So best case is 9-9. And for them to do that, they got to win the next 3 games. Like, period, end of discussion. They have to win the games against Iowa State at Iowa State. They have to win against TCU at home, and they have to win at Kansas State, which theoretically all are plausible. Iowa State generally is a harder team to beat in Ames, but they have no Tyrese Halliburton because he's out for the year. TCU, who knows what they're going to do, and then at Kansas State is, we'll see. But if we're talking about a path, 9-9 gets them to probably the 5 seed, and then they got to go beat Tech in the Big 12 tournament to even be in the bubble discussion.
So going into Iowa State and TCU, if they lose one of these games, then blank happens. Fill in the blank.
If they lose one of those games, then it's the NIT. Like there's no, like they have such a small path to getting to the NCAA tournament that they just, there's no way. Like if they lose to either at Iowa State, a Halliburton less at Iowa State, or at home against TCU, now we're talking about what seed in the NIT do they get? Like there's just not really a way around that at that point, in my opinion, short of Tim's, way, we won the Big 12 tournament. Look at that.
Well, yeah, which I think is super likely. If we lose one of those two games, it's the final nail in the coffin. Like that's,
yeah.
I guess, I mean, maybe the Oklahoma State game at home would be as bad or worse. I don't know. But yeah, if we lose one of those two games, it basically assures that an NCAA tournament berth is not just unlikely, it's probably impossible at that point. And impossible gives every Shaka hater a pretty easy nail to say 3 out of 5 didn't make the tournament. So, like we've been talking about, like I suppose at that point, if we lose one or both or whatever those games, then you're probably looking at a team that most likely won't beat West Virginia at home. So then you're adding another loss, and that's a team that maybe won't beat, you know, fill in the blank, like on the road or at home or whatever.
Yeah, so maybe 5-2 basically the rest of the way basically says, oh yeah, we're gonna lose to Tech and West Virginia, then try and win every other game. That's basically what 9-9 involves at this point.
Right.
So
with any of this stuff, like for us to really go on a run, I think it would take someone other than Matt or Jericho having a phenomenal 7-game stretch, and I
Courtney
just don't
Ramey
know who
wakes
I,
up.
Yeah, maybe. I mean that would be what it would take, I think. Or you know, or Andrew like discovers that he's not one of the slowest decision making ball handlers in the country. Or whatever, right? But
Andrew Jones watches a video on how to feed the post and goes,
so.
Oh, I didn't realize that was an option.
Or all three of our ball handling guards like, wait a second, I can initiate contact and still get a foul called? Incredible. Or whatever. It just seems so improbable that I can't imagine Courtney having 3 good games in a row, let alone 7. I can't imagine, you know, Kamaka stepping up 7 games in a row, let alone 2 or 3. I mean, it's whatever. So tough to put a whole lot of stock in any of it.
Yep.
Do y'all want to do an X's and O's breakdown of the TCU game, or do you just want to pretend you're getting to know us?
They need to keep the ball out of Desmond Bain's hands. He has 2 of them. And they need to
hard hitting analysis here.
Yeah. That's, he does in fact have 2 of them. They connect to some beautiful biceps.
There's your scouting report on TCU.
And then They try not to let Samuel dunk on them repeatedly, like what happened at DCU. There you go.
If the players love their coach, they need to be ready to rock. So that's that. I mean, at this point, it's kind of what it is to me. Like, they're on such a knife's edge. I guess we'll see if they feel like they can really bring it. Because if they want to play for Shaka's job, now is the time, I suppose. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing I would say in response to that, it's not exactly a rebuttal, but sort of context, is that if this team was going to give up, I feel like they would have done it after that West Virginia game. And the fact that they have worked their asses off the last few games tells me that they at least want to do it, right? They may not execute it. They may not be successful at it. But I don't doubt their desire to try and save their coach's job. Whether right. they do it, we'll see.
That's one thing that you can't, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Can't take it away from them.
Yeah, well, even that you can't, you know, bash on them about that is that they have been hungry still.
Yeah.
They haven't
given up. They have. And it's why I think they're going to win both those games. Like, I don't think we're going to lose to Iowa State and TCU. I don't think that we will.
Mark it down. They're losing to Iowa State and TCU.
Look, I didn't think they'd lose to Tech or Baylor, and they won both those games, so that's great.
Yeah, that's true. These are facts. Okay, pretending to know us. So, we pretend
I think Yang won New Hampshire tonight, so that's good.
You know, he did not. He Wait, did what? Not win anything, and he quit.
Oh. But we did beat Baylor and Tech.
Sure, yes, we did.
All right, well. 75% is good enough for me.
Good stuff. Good stuff. So you pretended we were football for the past, what is it, 50 minutes at this point, 45 minutes?
Incredible. Yeah, we might be right on the 60-minute mark today.
Yeah, we might. Yeah.
We might. So
congratulations, let's go ahead. Everybody. Now, you now listened to us during your lunch break.
Yeah. So now go ahead and pretend you're getting to know us. This week's question, as I told at the beginning of the show, is what's the worst movie you've seen from start to finish? So y'all have had an entire show to think about this. Who wants to start?
All right. So when I was in college was right at the time where kind of a rap revolution was happening. Started by a guy named Master P, which was, I want to say, like my senior year of high school. In fact, I know it was because it's like his hit song "Make 'Em Say was coming out right as I was finishing high school in '98. And then like the whole like Cash Money Millionaires. I'm having a hard time remembering what Master P's studio level, like No Limit, right? No Limit Records.
Yeah.
So
the gold tank. Yes.
Yep. So there was a, I would assume, straight to DVD or VHS movie at that point. And I remember it very much, called Hot Boys. And it starred Silk the Shocker and Snoop Dogg and Master P. And it was about a guy who like wanted to be in the rap game. And like his girlfriend died. And at the end, he's like, oh, I just, you know, I want to, love matters. And if you believe in love, things will be good for you. And it's just like, what? That's not what this movie is at all. Like,
what very much what I thought Master P was about was right. Love and respecting your woman.
I'm not sure that I understand. And I remember like there were a number of times throughout the entire movie that it was just like, it was just that bad. And like Mystical was in it. And I want to say Gary Busey was in it. And it was just,
I thought you were gonna go an entirely different way with this, and I thought you were gonna say Do the Right Thing.
No.
I was about to be like, well, this is gonna take us and plummet our rating pretty damn fast and get us in a lot of trouble.
I don't think Hot Boys is gonna be a hot take. Like, that movie was straight ass.
No. Do the Right Thing would have been a hot take.
Okay. I would just like to say for the record that I'm really glad you didn't go where I thought you were going to go and say 8 Mile was bad, because we were going to have to fight over that for the next, like, hour and a half.
Ratings would have gone skyrocketed.
Boy, I thought that movie was okay, I guess. Not great.
That's fine. I'll take okay. It's not a great movie, but the last, like, the battle scenes are awesome, and I would have been really angry with you if you had said 8 Mile was the worst movie you saw straight
nope, Hot Boys.
Okay.
Hot Boys. Johnny, what about you? What's your least favorite movie you've seen, or the worst movie, maybe not least favorite, worst movie you've seen from start to finish?
I mean, it's two, you know, six of one, half does the other, I guess, because I will bounce on a movie if I think it sucks. And now that I say that, I'm thinking of another movie that might even be worse than the one I'm about to mention.
So what's the best movie you've bounced on then, Johnny?
I don't know. Like, if I bounced on it, I thought it was terrible.
Well, you bounced on it, and then you watched it again. You're like, oh, wow, this is actually pretty good, and I shouldn't have bounced on it the first time.
So I've got two. My two bounced on ended up being good. Bullworth, which I bounced on, and then, like, the next time I watched it, like, damn, this is good. And then Office Space. I bounced on Office Space, and, like, then it became one of my favorites.
Yeah, see, me, if I go to the movies, I'm not bouncing. I'm not leaving the movie. I'm watching it to the end, no matter how bad the movie is.
Yeah, I think so. If we are talking about a movie that you're willing to watch start to finish, right? Like, it has to have a certain level of competency behind it in its execution, that it's good enough in some aspects that you're willing to roll with it for a while to see where it goes, right? Because if it's, you know, Howard the Duck or something, you're like, okay, this is terrible, and you can leave pretty early, right? Like, it's
except for Leah Thompson's hot as balls.
Well, yeah, I mean, I love that, but I was also like 11, so whatever, right? You know, like, at that point, I did, you know, Leah Thompson could have been in anything and I would have watched it. Anyway, the point being, if you hit it, there are certain movies that you see and you're like, okay, I'm immediately out on this. But there's other movies where you're like, I'm going to stick with it. And then there's a rare few movies where you're like, it's long as shit and I'm invested in it. And I feel like I need to stick this out to see where this goes. And so I watched Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. And
what is, okay, I don't remember that one. Just
you
should describe.
It's indescribable, frankly. Terrence Malick does not make many movies, right? Like, he takes a long time between them. He's getting a little more prolific by his standards, by which I mean he makes one every 7 years now as opposed to every 20. But he made a movie called Tree of Life that had Brad Pitt in it, and it was ostensibly about life in a small Texas town. And they film some of it in Georgetown and sort of central Texas area. So, like, there's reasons for me to be like, hey, you know, maybe I'll be interested in this. Like, I'll see some places I know, or, you know, it'll be kind of interesting. That movie's like a fucking 3 hours long at least. There is a 30-minute unspoken section that deals with evolution from the beginning of life to current time. I'm not making this up. Like, it's literally Terrence Malick walks us through Darwin, you know, Darwin's evolution of species is effectively what it is. There's like velociraptors and there's humans show up at some point. It is 30 minutes of the movie and there's no dialogue. And I sat through that whole thing being like, what the fuck am I watching?
And it didn't have any of the great music like Fantasia did.
No, it didn't. It was about a family in Central Texas that, like, they didn't talk a lot. And they just, I ended that movie and I was like, God damn it. I have spent 3 hours watching this thing. What the fuck, man?
I could have, like, beaten off six times.
Yeah, at least. Like, I mean, there was the whole 30-minute evolution thing, and there were some hot eggs in there. I could have knocked that out if I was so devoted. But it was just, Oh my God, that movie is fucking awful. And as we started this, I suddenly thought of Jupiter Ascending, which was terrible in its own right. And I really
that movie was so bad.
I remember hearing about that, but
it wasn't Hot Boys bad, but it was bad.
They made a Matrix movie about real estate in the galaxy. Is basically what it is. Like, they're like, hey, Mila Kunis, you're super hot. You want to get into like international real estate law for 2.5 hours? That's basically what the movie is.
Hard sci-fi. That's all it is. Yeah. Hard sci-fi. Yes.
Sci-fi international real estate law is effectively what it is. Oh, and Mila Kunis and Channing Tatum are in it, and he can certify, but not really, and nobody really explains it. It's terrible. Like, it's the Wachowski. They needed a timeout after that movie. But still, I'm gonna stick with Tree of Life. That was awful.
Nice. What's the movie that like the cities eat the other cities? Is it
Mortal Engines? Yeah, that was pretty bad. That was bad that was in its own way. Not yeah. Good. Yeah.
Did either of y'all see Cats?
No.
No, God no.
I don't
have the new Cats?
I don't have enough hallucinogens in the house. So we're gonna
Well, you don't need hallucinogens when you guys watch Cats.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you see it, Will?
No, I haven't. But I've seen the trailers, and I know I would hate it just by watching it. And yeah, I feel like they're going to go if they do a Cats 2, which it wouldn't surprise me because Hollywood is greedy as hell. But if they did, it would maybe go the same way as the movie I'm thinking of here, which I feel like it's a cop-out answer at this point. Sharknado. But I watched Sharknado back when and I remember there was a bunch of commercials for it being like, oh, Sharknado, it's going to be fucking super rad and epic and radical. But, and you watch it, and it's one of the only movies.
No one said that.
No, nobody said that, but there was like,
it's Will's cousin from Malibu is the one who said that.
But I went into that movie. I knew it was gonna be bad because I've heard about everything, but I went into it knowing it was a bad movie. But it kept me going because every time something happened, I would say to myself, "Oh man, it can't get worse than this. This is the lowest point a movie can get." And boy, was I wrong every single time until the very end. And that was when they were trying. Designed to be bad movies. Like that was really? Them trying to design a good movie, and then the second one was like, oh wow, everybody loved how bad that first movie was. Let's just make it even worse. So I thought,
and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I thought the sci-fi movies back then, and like at the point of Sharknado, they had already established a long lineage of really terrible movies. Like they were leaning into it. And I felt like the first Sharknado was them being like, we're going to make a really bad movie and also bring someone from 90210 along. Am I wrong about that?
I could be completely wrong. I could completely be wrong, but that was the worst movie I have ever watched start to finish.
Tim, you know shit movies. I can't watch. Can you tell me? Like you really like this Terry movie.
I think that I want to applaud Will watching it. I have no idea. I never watched it. I think the chances that anyone ever thought they were going to make Sharknado as a legitimate film.
A rad legitimate film.
Yeah, I just don't think so. But I do applaud you watching the whole thing all the way through. Now, what was the name of the 90210 guy in that movie?
Ian Ziering,
yep. I kept on thinking like Brian
Austin
Green.
Yeah, they didn't even get like the A-list 90210 guy. Right. They got like the C-list 90210 guy.
Yep. So the other guys would have been...
Who's still probably rich as
Luke
balls.
Perry, Brian Austin Green. Who was Jason Priestley? Is that right?
Yep.
That's right. Man. Yep. What could have been?
So here's what happened.
Was Sharknado 3 the Peach Pit dude?
So Sharknado... It released and it was a little bit more because they had done so much advertising for it. Yeah. It was slightly above average audience viewership for when it was released than a typical sci-fi original film at 1.5 million viewers. And it really caught on trending on Twitter where it was discussed by a lot of celebrities. like Damon Lindelof and Will Wheaton and Olivia Wilde.
Ooh, smoke show.
So they, you know, then they re-aired it, and it got even more viewership than the first time. And they kept on re-releasing it, and it kept on getting more viewership.
Yeah,
so they're like really made by the fact that there was social media at that point. So
yeah.
So the first time they released it was 1.5 million. The second time they released it was 1.89 million. And the third time they're like, oh, we're re-airing it. We got 2.1 million viewers. So it just kept on increasing, and I guess there is never really any decision to make it bad or, you know, whatever. I think they knew it was going to be a little silly, but
yeah, sci-fi seemed to do sort of silly bad for quite a while. I don't know if they still do that, but they seem to have like a phase where they're like, we're trying to make some mystery science theater sci-fi movies over here,
poke fun at themselves. But still, worst movie I've ever seen start to finish, and just because I didn't turn it off, just because I was like, there's no way this can get worse, and every time it would prove me wrong, and I was like, okay, well, I gotta see what the bottom is here in terms of cinema. We gotta understand where does this thing go.
It's the sunk cost,
right? Exactly.
Well, there you go.
What a way to tie this show together. And on that note, y'all, thank you for pretending we were football for the past hour. I've been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. Johnny Brashear, where can we find you?
I am available on Twitter at BitterWhiteGuy. I'm also on Bark and Carnival, producing a series of increasingly cynical recaps of Texas games. So you can really enjoy that. Also, you can find me on the Pretend We're Football podcast. You can find that on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere other than SoundCloud, basically. I'm going to say it's on Stitcher and Podbean and maybe some others.
There's I think we might be going back to SoundCloud pretty soon here, because I'm getting pretty fed up with Podbean.
Look at that. Yeah. Oh, that's right in my wheelhouse, SoundCloud. Right? Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, so that's where you can find me.
And where can we find Tim?
He's probably sleeping tonight, if I'm honest.
I don't think this is actually Tim. I think this is a Tim imposter, or, you know, what's the word? Doppelganger, who Tim has hired to Tim can sleep.
Tim has been tired. He's been asleep since the 30-minute mark. This is just a series of pre-recorded responses he's given because he knew what we were going to talk about.
It's like Multiplicity. So that I'm like the copy of the copy of Michael Keaton. Right now.
When do we get the smart Tim?
She tests my pee-pee, Johnny.
Oh, okay.
You can find me in my basement grading papers for the next 2.5 weeks. That'll be fun. I just took in over 1,000 pages of research papers from my seniors. Oh, boy. That's going to really suck. And then in about a month, you can find me on the tennis court coaching some great tennis players.
I'm going to go at least like 5-12 this year.
Oh, boy. you can find me at InsideTexas.com and on Twitter, InsideTexasHoop, no S. You can find me at Subway on Wednesdays for their turkey breast foot long. That's exciting. You can find me at Granite City every third Friday for their Parmesan oregano fries. Delicious. You can find me crying into my box of Triscuits when Texas loses their 5th game in 6 contests here pretty soon.
Well, this is a chipper episode. You guys, again, are listening to the Hornscast channel, which you guys can find on any podcasting platform out there. As Johnny so said, you guys can find us and other shows like this on that channel. On that note, thank you all for listening. We'll see you all next week. Hook 'em.
I'm so sorry, everybody. So sorry. Hook 'em.